Either she homeless or she got problems. That's the only reason why she run to a black man.
I like him already.
Now you wanna get nuts? Come on!
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome...
Producer, director, writer. He is the ultimate filmmaker and bona fide foodie. You're listening to The Quiddituzz Factor with Michael J. Arbouet.
Thank you for coming back. Greetings, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Quiddituzz Factor. I am your host, Michael J. Arbouet. Carpe diem, my friends. Carpe diem. What does that mean? It's a Latin word that means seize the day. There's another Latin word you should know. Quiditas. Adriana, please give them the definition.
Quiditas. Latin. The whatness of a thing. The essential nature of something. The quality that makes a thing what it is.
Yes. Quiditas is the whatness of a thing or person. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about perseverance and opportunity. Sometimes when we're discouraged, we are tempted to believe that only the lucky people get those opportunities. But a lot of times, you create opportunities. It reminds me of a quote by Richard Branson. And that quote is, if somebody offers you an amazing opportunity, but you're not sure you can do it, say yes. Then learn how to do it later. And that is the key to making things work for you. And there's someone who took every opportunity and turned it into gold. They are simply those people who understand that there's a little difference between obstacle and opportunity and are able to turn both to their advantage. And this woman that I'm talking about has done that all throughout her life. And that's exactly what Lisa G. Black has done. She's taken every opportunity and every difficulty and turned them into magic. When you hear her story, some of you might think, oh my God, this woman's been through so much. But when you hear her talk about it, you often will hear her laughing. You'll hear the smile in her voice. And that's because what most people think of difficult, she saw as opportunity. And she's used these opportunities, these difficulties throughout her life to become the person that she is. The way we deal with challenges can determine our success. In life, we experience failures. We make errors in calculations and judgment and get the rug pulled out from under our feet. Most of us never try to get back up again, but this person has. And if you listen to her story, you're going to realize as well that every difficulty you have, every problem you think you have, you can get over it. Nothing is impossible. There's another quote I love, and that's by Francis of Assisi. And that quote is, start by doing what is necessary, then do what is possible, and suddenly you're doing the impossible. So, let's welcome to the show, Lisa G. Black. Lisa, welcome, hello, how are you?
How are you, my friend?
I'm good, thank you for asking. So, my first question that I always ask all my guests is, what did you want to be when you grew up? Let's go back 8 or 9 years old, maybe 10 years old. What did you want to be?
Yeah. You know, I'll even go as far back as when I am the third girl in a family of four. I have two elder sisters, one that's actually 10 years my senior. And the reason why I'm saying that is because, you know, I was born in 1968. I'm a proud 52. I'll own it. Yeah. So I grew up with older siblings and older cousins all that were born from 1940 to, you know, right before I was born, 1965. So I've always been around older people, people of the 60s, people of that era where they were kind of pushing boundaries. And I grew up in a very upper middle class New Jersey neighborhood. My father was a doctor. Education meant everything. His parents were immigrated over from Italy in the 20s. So I grew up with an immigrant mentality, education, better the next generation. But we always had this kind of standard of, you know, being around my older siblings and older cousins, you know, I was exposed to things. And I don't mean this in a bad way, but I was exposed to like amazing music. Like they had, you know, they introduced me to Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones at the time I was 6 or 7. And my father had a big passion for that. So why am I telling you this? I'm saying this because music and the theater. My father would take us to New York all the time, even as young as I was at six. And so I was exposed to culture, all kinds, visual culture, and also, you know, music and just experiences that with travel that I always had this kind of creative background. And so I began playing, you know, I think my start is that I began playing music at the age of 6 or 7. I started out on violin and then I moved to clarinet, and I played clarinet for about 20 years. So on that side, you know, I would write poetry from the time I was probably 9. So there was a creative streak in me, but then I'm kind of a paradox because, again, third daughter of 4 children. My brother was the baby. My elder sisters did everything my parents told them. They studied all the time. They were kind of geeky. But we loved them. But I was the one that always wanted to play sports. I was captain of my soccer team. And from a very early age, I always took on this like leadership role. Even though my siblings were older, I would be the one they would come to. I'd be the one to kind of, you know, make everybody laugh or, you know, think of a new fun and creative, and we don't do this anymore, but we used to come up with like games to play with the neighborhood kids, like, you know, Total Spies, and we'd have Russians against the Americans, and we'd hide plans around our neighborhood. Like, I was always coming up with, you know, kind of like the Pied Piper in a sense. So, you know, my origins is that. I mean, I always had this want to be around creative people. I would say I performed a lot in talent shows in junior high, and but I never, like, you know, in my mind did I always maybe wanted to be an actress, maybe, but I was more of a comedian. I did a lot of stand-up. In my late high school years, I did stand-up comedy. Go figure, but I did. So funny. Anyway,
comedy too. That's so funny.
Yeah. No, I mean, I used to do a real good, you know, Rosanna Dana, God right. rest her soul, Gilda Radner. And I, you know, I was a big fan of Joan Rivers. And so, you know, I wasn't a clown. I just liked to perform. There always was, you know, a need to want to be around creative people. And so I think, yeah. So in a long-winded way, I think it started with my love of music and poetry, and then it came around to just wanting to be around really interesting folks. And then, you know, the weird part was, is I ended up going to prep school my last 2 years of high school. And I only mention this because, you know, think about that. You grow up with all of your friends from the time you were in kindergarten, and, you know, your last 2 years of secondary education, you got pulled out to go to private school. So, I mean, I'm blessed. I went to the Petty School in Hightstown, New Jersey. We had some amazing people come out of there. You know, a couple of Oscar nominated short film winners and a couple of actors and some, you know, really amazing people. But it did prove the more of the traditional route, go to college, get a liberal arts education, think about a corporate world. So I gave up a lot of my creative dreams when I went to college. So, and I went to Boston University. So, I was an English literature major in Boston.
So the next step in your journey is that you go to Boston University and you study English lit. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was an English literature major and I was an art history minor. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I lived in this dorm, 6th floor, Miles Standish, and my best friend in the whole world, an amazing person, and he was writing screenplays on the side while he was getting his degree in accounting or marketing, but he was in the School of Business. And this gentleman and I have remained friends for 30 years, and I was, you know, very much a part of his journey. And I don't know if I want to mention it or not, but he wrote the very first Iron Man, and he was also Oscar nominated for Children of Men. So that is how I started to really get on a tertiary side, you know, kind of on the side level, on the best friend level of getting into film, was through his passion for sending out his scripts in screenwriting competitions and being his cheerleader and telling him that, you know, this one was great, this one was not. And so I'd say that's how it started, you know, with film. Halfway through my career at at BU, I had something called a detached retina, which, you know, Sugar Ray Leonard has, you know, most boxers get it. Mine was just a spontaneous detachment. I had very, very, very poor eyesight, basically Mrs. Magoo. And for whatever reason, it fell off. And so at the time, I had to fly home in emergency surgery. I had a massive something put in my eye. They don't do this procedure anymore, but it was like a buckle and you had to stay blind. Wait for it. I had both my eyes patched blind for 6 months. Wow. So right smack in the middle of my college years, I was back home in New Jersey on my parents' couch, patched blind, and, you know, just like, holy, holy fuck, basically. Yeah. So, you know, after the 6 months was up and I was able to then go and take some courses at Seton Hall on the side. So I took some courses there and then I eventually returned back to BU to finish my degree. But of course, you know, I was delayed. We didn't have books on tape back then. And I still was typing papers on a typewriter. So we didn't have all the fancy smancy. So I officially graduated 2 years after what I would have graduated. So it took me an extra 2 years to you know, finish all my requirements. You know, from there I returned back from Boston and I got a place in Manhattan. And my very first job was at Price Waterhouse, and it wasn't Cooper's yet. So I went straight right into Big Six accounting, is what we used to say at the time. And I did, I was, you know, I was an assistant, administrative assistant, but I was in the marketing development, corporate giving arm of that company. So that's where I really cut my teeth on business. You know, I was in the room with people who were CEOs at the time. B.K. Whitmore was the CEO of Kodak and the CEO of Chemical Bank and Seagram's. And so my whole job was to help the woman who was the director of business development put together plans on how we could best strategically market the firm, because there was a rule at the time you couldn't market an accounting firm. You couldn't go after, you couldn't poach business. But if you heard wind that somebody was disappointed, you know, with their tax with a different accounting firm, then it was our job to go and find what charitable event that CEO was of that company that was looking to switch accounting firms, and then put all the, buy the table, thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars, and put the partners there. I was able to go to Davos like 3 or 4 different times. So that was a whole side of business that I got to learn. I got to understand finance and how corporate structures work and the inner workings of that. And I was, you know, grateful for that. I mean, but all the while, the creative side in me was there. So, you know, this is the early 90s. Corporate social giving wasn't really as heavy as it was now. And I was able to kind of convince some of the partners to go ahead and start participating in things like Take Your Daughter to Work Day. So I was a part of the very first Ms. Foundation Take Your Daughter to Work Day. So I was still being creative because I was putting together all the logistics for the entire, you know, North American, all the company, you know, all the branches of PwC to implement that day. So just think about that. So that's where you get the, you know, we think about producers and what they do. I mean, each thing that you do coming up in life, even though if it's not related to film, you do pull up, you know, on that skill set. So for that, I mean, just think about the logistics of having to coordinate, you know, close to, you know, 102 offices all trying to do something that they didn't really understand. It was a male dominated industry nonetheless. And here we were asking partners to be like, hey, Take Your Daughter to Work Day. And there was, you know, a coordinated effort across, you know, many, many different channels and logistics and how we were going to run it, and then working with the Ms. Foundation. So now you're working with a third party. So, you know, those skills, you don't see it at the time when you're in it. So, you know, anybody younger, you know, just starting out in their careers listening to this, I would say, you know, don't not take something just because you think it's not in the film world or it's not in television. It's a, no, you know, you take something that, you know, allows you to build a skill set that you can, you know, then draw upon, because you never know down the line when you're going to draw back on that skill set.
Wow. What an incredible story. To be in a room and learn from all those creative people must have been amazing. You must have felt the electricity in the air, that feeling that magical things were about to happen. Am I right about that?
100%. And then for me, I think it was because I was such, I mean, back then, I was, you know, all of 25 and I was, you know, really just very confident and, but a sponge, like I wanted to learn things. And what I learned was I had an energy that actually took some of these older gentlemen who have been, you know, doing what they're doing, whether it's tax or mergers and acquisitions. And, you know, it was a crazy time in the 90s, you know, but they were in the same roles all the time. And I spun it. I made them think about, wait, there's other things you guys can do and have a presence, you know, and do something. And I even got to buy all the art for the offices, which was insane. So there you go. Like you just, I guess they fed off my energy. I fed off the fact that I was, and this is interesting, I was in the inner circle at a very high level, even though I was, you know, my title, I think, was assistant to the business development. I mean, it wasn't, you know, nobody was hung up on titles back then. It was about just being a sponge, but then not being afraid to speak up. And I think that's always been my case, you know, even though, you know, I wasn't a partner in the firm, I would speak up if I thought, there was something worth them hearing and worth them implementing. And, you know, I would say 8 out of 10 times, you know, they would listen and it was, that was kind of fun for me, you know? Yeah. So from Pricewaterhouse, and by the way, in college, I worked at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and I was a docent, so there's public speaking right there. And then after that, I got a position for an agency. They're a very big agency now. I worked for GMR Marketing, and at the time, they were out of Illinois, and they were hiring people to represent import specialty brand called Molson Beer from Molson Breweries, and you were working alongside Miller Brewing Company manufacturing representative. So I did not work for a distributor. I was actually the manufacturer, right? So the whole job was to go and figure out ways how to take the national overlays or the international overlays coming out of Canada and then tweaking them to, you know, a region or a local area. So I had New York and New Jersey and all of the distributors who distributed Molson, and then all of the on and off premises as well, right? I mean, through the distributor, three-tier network. So that was a whole nother industry that I got to kind of, and I'm glossing it over, but I learned a lot in the beer industry. So again, I was hired by GMR, but GMR was then hired, obviously, was a contract with Miller Brewing Company. And only after a year and a half of being, you know, working with the Molson Breweries and Miller Brewing Company at the time, Molson was licensed by Miller Brewing Company. So they hired me on in the marketing department, and very, very quickly, again, like Pricewaterhouse, you know, it was a male-dominated industry from the beer guy you saw at the, you know, at the restaurant all the way, you know, to the, you know, the people who worked at the distributorship to, you know, there weren't a lot of women in 1996, 97, working in the alcoholic beverage industry. There just weren't, it was not the way it is now. And so, you know, I don't know how I keep ending up in male dominated industries, but yeah, you know, learned a lot again, because for when you're in beer, you have to learn how to market something, not only implement something top down, but then also create things that were specific to the region that I was responsible for. And my paycheck, you know, I had a big T&E, and I, you know, had free rein to do a lot of interesting, you know, kind of marketing things, which now have names called street marketing. Like back then, we didn't have a name for it. We just did it. We just hired a bunch of people and, you know, would go out and you know, get, we create these little marketing campaigns where we would go out into bars and, you know, have contests, but that was all created by the local office, by me. And funny enough, we ended up doing stuff with segmented marketing, which, you know, back then, again, now we talk about it, it's like no brainer for everybody. But then, you know, I hate to say this on a podcast, but, and I'll be just generous and kind, most people back then, when you thought of segmentation marketing, they would say, oh, okay, if it's Hispanic marketing, we'll put a Mexican flag on it. And, you know, that's Hispanic marketing. And they didn't quite understand in the New York, you know, all the different subsets of, you know, you know, the Bronx and Dominican Republic and, you know, and Caribbean marketing. And so I was able to kind of go back to Milwaukee and convince them to say, hey, look, that doesn't work for us. You know, that's not going to sell our beers. Or in the case of, you know, Miller Genuine Draft, when I finally came on MG, you know, Miller Brewing Company, again, you know, they didn't quite understand that not everything needed to be a 40-pack, you know, 40-ounce bottle, that, you know, people actually enjoyed it. So, God, I mean, I'm going on and on. I could talk forever, but these are the kinds of things that you don't think come into play when you're a film producer, but it does, because now you're working with, you know, people's education from high school all the way up to, you know, people with MBAs. So now you're having to work with, you know, multi-level people, people who own their own businesses, what's in it for them, and budgets, and, you know, and spend my money here and spend my money there. And then, you know, at the end of it, towards the end of my career with alcoholic beverages, you know, I was literally running all of the North American marketing and, you know, things from sports to, you know, film placement or whatever. I mean, it was our job for the region. So, and you have to learn how to deal with that.
Did you find it hard working in an all-male environment? How did you deal with that?
You know, I was one of the first women in my office, in the New York office, to actually have a baby, to get pregnant and have a baby. And, you know, having to nurse my child and make time for nursing and stuff like that. So, I mean, I really was, you know, kind of on the cutting edge of getting people comfortable with, you know, women, you know, who get pregnant and still work. I mean, I went back to work 8 weeks after having my first child. Would I do that again? No. But I loved what I did. I mean, wow. You know, we did something called like Solo Conventacion and we did MTV Singled Out, you know, which, oh, let me digress. One funny story. Mm-hmm. When I was still in college, when I went back to finish my degree, I had to wear an eye patch, right? Mm-hmm. And at the time, Remote Control, which was a game show on MTV, 1989, it was the second season. They came up to the school to get, you know, contestants, and, you know, they picked me. So if you go into the files of the Television Museum of Arts and Sciences, you will find my episode. I was the very first episode when Kari, started. Mm-hmm. And, I was on Remote Control. So, you know, they said they liked it because I was, you know, I wore the patch and I was, you know, bubbly and, you know, had force. So again, talk about crossroads. They offered me an internship, but this was 1989. I mean, the network wasn't even around that long. So I was like, no, I better go get a real job. Like, I didn't think back then, right?
Right.
What it was now.
Your story is so inspirational, and I know my listeners must be feeling the same way. And all the hats that you've worn, all the jobs that you've had, was fear ever a factor? Were you ever afraid?
I wasn't afraid to say, you know, I don't know, but I'll learn and keep applying those skills on all the different industries, right? I wasn't afraid to say, oh, this is not for me. I didn't pigeonhole myself.
Wow.
That's, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, then I had my second child. I tried the stay-at-home mom thing. It was not for me. And because I like to be around people, I realized, you know, as the older you get and stuff, I feed off of, and you and I met, and I think, you know, you remember the first time we met. Mm-hmm. For me, I find people fascinating. I want to know everything about them, you know, and immediately I want to help them. You know, and I found that was where I felt, you know, joy. I feel joy when I can connect people, make things happen, share knowledge, not hold my knowledge, you know, tight to the vest and, you know, in the hopes I get something out of it. Who cares, you know? So I always lived my life like that. I went back and got my MBA when my kids were small. Why? I don't know. I guess because I just felt like, all right, well, let me get an MBA. And I got it in strategic leadership and marketing. And at the time, I was living in Princeton, New Jersey. And my next door neighbor was a scientist in licensing for Bristol-Myers Squibb. And he's like, you know, we need people who have consumer marketing experience. And again, this pharmaceutical marketing back in 2000s was not what it is now. Mm-hmm. And I've always found myself on the ground floor of things, you know, as they're growing. And so I was hired by Bristol-Myers Squibb into the marketing department. But for me, coming from beer, I had to see how things were sold. I had to see how a drug was sold. So I asked to be a pharmaceutical representative. So I actually carried the bag, as we say in the industry. Mm-hmm. And the only territory open was Delaware. So that's how I got the Delaware.
Oh my goodness.
That's how I got the debt. It was a job transfer here. And I was only supposed to be here a couple of months. And I liked being in the field so much that I was like, I'm not going to come inside yet. And I didn't until 2006 when we launched the biologic for rheumatoid arthritis. So then they're like, okay, you need to come back inside. But I stayed in Delaware. I just commuted every day, 92 miles each way every day. Yeah, I'm insane. So 2006. Okay. So this is where the overlap comes. So back to my darling friend from university, finally got his big break. He made a one film that, you know, no one ever saw. And then the next one, he was able to get money and he was the very first film in New Mexico to be shown New Mexico as New Mexico. And that was a film called First Snow. And this is a script that he had written, you know, years before it ever got made. It was 12 years in the making. And, you know, he's my best friend. He was directing it, first-time director. And so I started fielding calls from him. And we would share stuff back and forth. I'm grateful that I was able to be a part of that intimate process of him, you know, hiring a line producer and da-da-da. All the while, I was working in pharmaceuticals. So I was blessed because I took my vacation to go out and watch my best friend film his first feature. So I took 2.5 weeks and went out on set. And that was the very first time I was ever on set and around, you know, physical production. And immediately I knew kind of all along, just kind of being in it, you know, on the side as the best friend. But it was the being on set with all those amazing people below and above the line on First Snow that I realized that, okay, wait a second. There's more than just driving 92 miles each way every day. While I loved working in pharmaceuticals, I felt like that was the first time I really felt the pull to say, okay, maybe it's time to shift gears again. So, in a nutshell, the film was being finished and it was stalled and nobody knew what to do with it. And I was given the opportunity to go out and talk to the producers and say, look, why don't I take it around the festival circuit? I didn't even know what that was, but I was able to get it into Tribeca. We had a world premiere at Tribeca. And from there, I just learned, you know, trial by fire, boots on the ground. And I learned how to actually market and distribute, you know, promote a film after it's been completed, you know, in real time.
Wow.
Which is insane.
That is amazing. Wow.
So, yeah. So then I left, I turned 40 and I, you know, just said, okay, I'm all in. I'm going to open my own single. I'm going to, you know, basically started out as a consultant, meaning mostly helping my creative folks that I had met along the way. And I was introduced to a lovely, lovely up and coming filmmaker named Ash Christian. And Ash had just had some success on his first feature out of Sundance. And we were introduced in Manhattan. And we became really good friends. And he was, I think, 19 at the time when I met him. And from there, you know, just started to, you know, keep that relationship going in addition to the relationship, of course, that I have, you know, with my friends on First Note. And slowly from there, I decided to start Garnet Girl, and it didn't, you know, I had a mission for it. I had thought, okay, let me basically start out like a manager, even though I wasn't an official manager, but also let me get to understand what producing was. I mean, I got a little taste of it on that first project, but, you know, I wasn't officially a part of stuff. So I made the decision as a business owner, right, in my own money. And I invested into my company and said, I need to go to the European film market. So I didn't go to AFM. So my very first market was the European film market, which takes place in Berlin. And I stepped off the plane in 2008 and knew nobody, knew nothing. And I got a badge and I just slowly, you know, took the skills that I had from corporate America and realized, okay, well, let me just network. Let me ask for meetings. Let me, you know, tell people, you know, that I always said, I don't know. Can you teach me? And you'd be amazed when you say, hey, I don't have that answer, but, you know, do you, and can you help me? So I was blessed. I met some interesting people over there right off the bat. I met Michael Favall from Odin's Eye, who's a sales agent, been in the business years and years and years, out of Australia. And he and I became very good friends. And he would answer a lot of the questions that I didn't even understand, you know, what he did. And he, you know, really showed me what sales agents do. And I just learned, you know, that way, just, you know, by meeting people, talking with people, and then always in having writers, you know, in my makeup of what I do. So, you know, having, you know, Mark as my best friend and somebody understanding the creative process from the script side, and then having Ash Christian, who at the time was a writer director and is now a prolific producer. God love him. So I always understood it all starts from the script, but there's always this business side that I started to see that even in Europe, they didn't quite understand how to tap into all the facets of what it takes to create something and bringing it to the world. And that to me, I started to see where to connect the dots. So I can take my business side and my business expertise and my love and passion for creatives and marry that together. And so I started to, you know, find financiers that would be interested in supporting emerging filmmakers. And then I also realized very quickly the European grant system, and really, you know, studied and learned that and you know, did a lot of research. So there's those skill sets coming back all the way back from Pricewaterhouse. A lot of research, a lot of reading of white papers and reading tax, you know, papers that would come out about different incentives and why the incentives are there in different countries. It takes, you know, you have to do your work. You have to do your homework. You know, you can't just ask somebody and then just repeat it. No, I mean, you had to really back it up with facts, right? So I started to learn that side of the business. And I was fortunate because I was able to then meet some more people who invited me over to Norway in 2010 on a producing envoy. But before that, I actually went to Colombia, the country of Colombia, in 2009. Same thing, on a producing envoy. So that's the problem with me. When people say producer, you know, I can do a number of things for some people. You know, if somebody wants to understand the tax system or want to understand how incentives work or how does that fit into, you know, them getting their film made, I would say the biggest thing that I tell anybody, whether you're a seasoned person or you're an emerging filmmaker, is don't ever say to somebody, I just need money so I can make my film. No, then those are the people I run from. You know, what you want to say is, can you, you know, do you have, what can you bring to the table? What facet of the whole trajectory of filmmaking can you help me with? Because I want XYZ audience to see this film. You always have to think about what the exhibition is, right? The ultimate end game is you want somebody to see your film, not make the film, not get money and make it and what, it sits on the shelf. So, and every single person you bring into that timeline, if you will, or that overreaching trajectory is important, because at any given time, if you pick the wrong partner and you don't understand, you know, what you're doing or what you're making, and you cannot convey that to that, you know, entity that comes into the mix, that's when a lot of hiccups happen. That's when a lot of heartache happens. That's when a lot of people who, you know, have said, oh my God, I wish I never went with that sales agent. Oh my God, I got taken advantage of. Because if you're not steering that all the way through, you know, you take the risk of it never, you know, going as well as it should.
I hope the people that are listening to this podcast are taking notes, because this is exactly what they need to hear. A lot of people, when they go to make their movies, they just want to make a movie and they don't understand the business behind it. And you're giving great insight on what it takes to make a movie. Tell me a little bit more about that process.
It's about teams, right? I mean, if you're a writer, you're going to need, and you're not going to direct your project, but, you know, let's just say you're a filmmaker where in Europe, they're mostly writers and directors. They write and direct their own stuff. You know, the problem is that who you pick as your producer, you know, there's different, you know, they're taught in film school, oh, it's character development, it's development process, it's putting a pitch deck together. No, it's not. And this is what I learned from corporate America, is that 9 times out of 10, you're not talking about the project when you get in the room with the right decision maker or key decision maker, or what we'll call a stakeholder. Okay, business term, stakeholder. You're not talking about your project. You're selling yourself. You're selling the team. You're selling the vision. And you and I don't mean that in when people say sell it, people, you know, their skin crawls a bit. I don't mean it like that. If you really truly believe in what you want to say, what you want to get across, and who to whom you're saying it to, then it makes it very easy for the person that you are wanting to bring onto your team to get excited, to what we used to say in corporate America, be engaged, and almost then you motivate them not by, you know, a hammer and a nail. You motivate them because they want to believe in, they're now a part of the team and part of the process. And I think that's a huge lesson to learn for filmmakers, that even when you're at, say, markets or festivals, you know, they're always like selling. They're always like pitching. Take a beat and, you know, talk about yourself. Talk about your kids. Be a human being and ask questions to that person. See who they are. See if they're the right fit for you as well. You know, what they believe in, what they can, you know, do, what they, you know, do they resonate with what you're saying? That's important. You know, otherwise, if you're running around these markets and festivals and just pitching all the time, at some point, you know, people just get glazed over. They don't see you as a human. And I think that's kind of, for me, you know, again, it's about engaging in humanity, right? It's engaging in, you know, understanding the person that's standing in front of you, and not always just, as I'm rambling on here incessantly, you know, talking. You know, listening is important as well. You know, engaging somebody, and I think that's important, because then, you know, it's easier. I think, you know, for me, 12 years into this now, you know, if somebody was asked me, and I've been blessed. I've worked with some great international film festivals. I've been blessed to have produced close to, what, 9 feature films. And remember, in 2008, it was the worst economic downturn since, you know, the pandemic this year. Yeah. When I started my company, I started in you know, what was, you know, better known as a recession. But I didn't let it scare me. I said I jumped in all in. I jumped off the bridge and I never looked back. And I think it's that belief in yourself, but it's also just constantly learning and researching, and if you don't know something, know it. So for me, 12 years later, I was blessed because I didn't just meet filmmakers or do script breakdowns and develop scripts that way. I learned who the stakeholders were, what they did, and what they mean for the whole trajectory of a project. So I'm blessed because I'm good friends and have nice colleagues that I can call up at every stage of the process, from a financier to a sales agent to a distributor to, and I've gotten to know them as people and not just what's in it for me, right? Just, you know, just whatever, even if there's nothing in it, but understanding from, as I say, script to screen, to me, those are the best producers. And there's a lot of producers out there that don't do that. They will, you know, get it to a point where you're in production and you're on set. And, you know, as soon as the last slate is, you know, clicked, they're out the door. And, you know, and they're relying on the sales agent to pull your movie through. I would not suggest that. I mean, I would say that, you know, you want to be there the whole way. I mean, it's not easy. And so that's a true producer, in my opinion. And there's been a lot of talk in the PGA about some people who call themselves producers of marketing distribution, and, you know, they come on things later. I don't mind those people. I mean, if that feels like that's their strong skill set, great. I just happen to be blessed that I, you know, started out with screenwriters and directors, and I understand that process. And I also understand from my business sense, the marketing and distribution. So I'm, you know, some people call me the fairy godmother, you know.
Wow.
And it's not being in control. It's learning how to pass the baton. That's the other, you know, if you have to say, you know, what makes good teams, it's really learning when to be in the leadership position, when to set the strategy, right? Mm-hmm. And then also when to pull back and allow the people that you have brought into your team to do what they do best, pass the baton. It's, you know, I used to run track in high school, and that's kind of my analogy is that, you know, if you ever watch a track meet, you know, if you run a 4x100 or a 4x400, I mean, you know, you're passing that baton, and the strategy comes even before the race to say, wait a second, on this particular race, based on the competitors that we have, we're running against, you're going to run anchor, I'm going to run, you know, first leg out, you're going to run middle leg. And it was never this, you know, we would just adjust to who we were running against and what we wanted to accomplish. And that's how you win a race. But it's being confident enough in the people that you're running with that you can hand that baton off and not feel like you have to be in control all the time. I think that's the other big lesson, that if people can just trust other people and trust the fact that you chose those people, right? Trust in yourself, because you've chosen to be a part of your project or part of your team, mm-hmm. and then allow that person to do what they do best, you'd be surprised how successful, you know, you can be. So,
here at the Quiditas Factor, we have a bunch of signature questions I like to ask all my guests. So the first question for you is, what's something that people seem to misunderstand about you?
Because I have such a passion and love for people, and I'm, you know, outgoing and gregarious, that I'm you know, an extrovert, but truly, I'm kind of an introvert. I am. I like, you know, when I'm not out in the world, you know, at some event or some festival or making a film, I really truly appreciate my time at home with my family, with my husband and my daughters when they were home, but they're now off and grown. And I love my bed, you know, I love my bed. You know, and I also think people think that, I don't want to say that I'm stronger than I am, but that I have a tougher shell than I really do. I get hurt. Mm-hmm. I get hurt by people. I think it's because I believe in some people so much that, you know, maybe I don't keep my guard up. But to me, I don't know. I always joke about that and say, look, you know, if I get hurt, that's the battle wounds of putting yourself out there. Otherwise, you know, what's the point? You know, if I could, yeah, I'm Catholic by religion. And I always say, well, you know, for me, you get to the pearly gates and St. Peter said, you know, look at, you did good, kid. You know, look at all the people that you touched. And even if I had nothing to gain from it other than to watch somebody else go on and be successful, you know, for me, that's lovely. You know, that's the joy, you know, so I'm a softie.
Tell me about a person that touched your heart and how they helped you be your best self.
You know, I think everybody I bring into my life, or I, you know, I think you felt this. I mean, I immediately will just take somebody in as my family. So I kind of get, touched by everybody that I work with, or I'm involved with, or I'm friends with, or my family. Because I love the uniqueness in everybody.
I'm sure you get a lot of them, but what is the best compliment you've ever received?
I was meeting, oh my God. Well, if I meet too, now remember, you know, I'm a woman of a certain age, but I'll be good. you know, actually had somebody say I had a voice like Brenda Vaccaro. I thought that was kind of nice. If you can remember who she was. I think the best compliment I ever received was unexpected. It was somebody I never met before. We exchanged emails. He was an entertainment attorney for some very famous British writers and directors and producers who he was now out on his own in New York. And he had asked for a meeting, and I met him at City Bakery, and I'll never forget it, on 18th Street. Right. And I was there. He was there first, and I had come in. And if you know anything about City Bakery, it's this gigantic space, really high ceilings, tons of people. And I walked in, and I didn't know what he looked like. And I texted him and said, oh, I'm here. And so when I got to the table, he said, oh, I knew it was you from the moment you walked in the door, because the entire room, which is like 25-foot ceiling, lit up. That was like, this is a stranger. He says, your energy. He was you know, from India. So I even took that as a bigger compliment, because, you know, they're very much in tune with energy and spirituality and that, you know, kind of sixth sense. And I was blown away. He's like, I just knew it was you from the moment you walked in the door. So yeah, that was kind of a great compliment.
Outside of producing, what are you interested in right now?
Science in the world. No, I mean, honestly, it's, this pandemic is really, as somebody who has been through a lot of trials and tribulations, in addition to my eye being detached, I suffer from something called trigeminal neuralgia. It's a facial pain nerve disorder that, it's pretty rare. It's like, you know, 2 in 200 people, you know, get, but it's pretty rare, and it's very painful. I suffered a brain surgery right after I made a film called Almost Paris, to fix it, but it did come back in 2 years. So, I'm very sensitive to people's suffering. To me, what weighs on my mind right now is this pandemic, is this virus, and the fact that people are not paying attention to people's suffering. And mostly I feel, and as a white woman, I'm heartbroken. And remember, I was in pharmaceuticals, and one of the drugs I used to sell was for diabetes, and I reside in Delaware. And, you know, we have a heavily African-American population, and diabetes is one of like 3 in the country of the highest populations of diabetes. And so it is not a joke when they say, you know, certain, you know, ethnicities are because of various reasons are going to suffer even more greatly by this pandemic than others. And I want people to pay attention to that. I want policies to change so that we never have to break down how a pathogen, right? Because we're all made of the same stuff, you know, genes and molecules and water and, you know, matter. And I never, ever, ever, ever want to have somebody break down a virus or a pandemic like this again by somebody's skin color. Mm-hmm. You know, I worry about how we're all going to move forward. Listen, you met me. I am a person of, you know, I'm, you know, if you meet me, I'm going to hug you. And I, you know, the fact that we're probably not going to be able to hug people, for the next 5 years, you know, is sad to me. Yeah. It's sad. I mean, I'm Italian, I'm a Mediterranean, you know, person, and I'm tactile, and, you know, it drives me crazy that I can't, you know, hit somebody in the elbow and just be like, hey, and hug my friends and hug my family. And, you know, just, so that bothers me. And I write a lot of poetry still. So yeah, that's what I do.
On all the many projects that you've worked on over the years, tell me about a funny story that happened to you on set.
I have two. Can I say two?
Absolutely.
Okay. So the first one, we were shooting a film called Miles, which you can, you know, watch on all the platforms, directed by the amazing, beautiful Nathan Adloff. I loved my crew so much on that film. And we were, there's a part of the film where we shot in White Plains, New York, in somebody's house. And we were in the basement. We were shooting the scene, and all of a sudden the I think it was the key grip said, "Do you guys smell that?" And we're like, "Yeah, it smells like gas." And, you know, you have all that lighting equipment, and, you know, we're all, and it was a tiny house. It wasn't like a big house. It was like in a very 1950s, you know, small, you know, raised cape. And we're in this really tiny basement, and we're like, holy fuck. So we ran outside, we called the fire department, and the people we rented the home from, you know, we saved their house because apparently it had been leaking for, you know, weeks. Wow. Before we even moved in, and it, we could have blown the entire neighborhood. So the fun part of that story was, of course, you know, while the firemen are, you know, making sure that everybody was safe, there was an ice cream truck coming down the neighborhood, and the costume designer, the great Chris Rosa, and myself and another producer, you know, we're like, well, we're just sitting there on this lawn. And so we got, you know, the old fashioned popsicles where they're like two, you know, and we would split them between us. And we sat and ate popsicles while, you know, we waited for the house not to blow up. So that's the one fun moment. It was fun. I mean, it was, at some point you have to start laughing because we're like, oh my God, we all could have been blown to kingdom come. And then the second was the most unbelievable, magical thing is, and I don't know who may or may not know this about me. So I have niched focus a lot of my films, and I shoot them and have been a part of films in Scandinavia and, you know, working with the country of Norway. I was on a film set of a film that I just finished called The Birdcatcher, which you can watch on Amazon Prime. And it was shot in the winter. It was shot in the snow, and we were in a remote part of Norway. And it was very late night. The bridge had frozen out, the bridge that we took all the cars to come back and forth to set. It's now about 3 o'clock in the morning. Crystal clear night, freezing cold, but crystal clear. And we had to figure out how to get everybody back to the cabins where we were staying. And the only solution that we could do, because the road was the bridge was out, was to snowmobile in sleds. So that, you know, the sleds, like if you were skiing and you got hurt and you're like the body's laying the sled. So they have these sleds that the snowmobiles pulled. And, you know, there you are at 3 o'clock in the morning after, you know, a 12 hour shoot, and you're sitting, you know, going through fields of snow, you know, with this furry Nordic blanket on you, and you're going, oh my God, you know, the stars are out, they're crystal clear, every star in the sky you can imagine, and you're saying, I am so blessed. Like, how privileged am I to be able to have this experience? I mean, just, you know, to me, that was the coolest thing ever, that you were, you know, sledded out and you look up and the northern lights were going, and then you're just like, I'm blessed. You know, this labor of love that took forever to make, and, you know, everything that had gone, you know, wrong, you know, in the stress of, oh my God, the bridge is out. And then in this miracle moment, you're experiencing this memory that, you know, to the day I close my eyes, I'm never going to forget. I mean, it was just magical, magic.
I have two more questions for you. And this one is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, we didn't talk about, you know, the project specific, which, you know, I don't mind. And I think you wanted to know more about what it takes to, I think. Okay. The one thing, again, I just want to reiterate again, is that, you know, no matter how, listen, I ran on for close to, I don't know how long it's been now, but I anybody who's listening to this, I think I really want them to understand, especially in the time of the isolation that we're in, take the time to, you know, even if you're in the film industry and, you know, maybe there is something else that you can work on while we're figuring out how to go back into production. But, you know, maybe it's something that you have a skill in that, you know, is not related to anybody in your line of work. You know, maybe it's the grocery clerk down the street when you go in to buy your groceries, if you don't do Instacart, that you can inspire. I mean, take the time to always, you know, think about carefully who, even in a minute that you meet somebody, even if it's for a minute, that you, your energy, your interaction with that other individual, it does leave an impact. And you have the choice, even if you're not feeling upbeat or you're feeling down or you're feeling isolated, if you just think of it outside of yourself and even in the little moments of every day, if you take time to say, you know, I'm grateful, I'm joyful that I'm breathing, I'm healthy, I'm alive, and, you know, maybe it's just a 2-second friendly word, even to a stranger, you'd be amazed that even in that little encounter that you may have touched somebody, you know, and help bring joy. I mean, we need to bring joy to each other, period.
As you know, the name of the show is called The Quiditas Factor, and quiditas is the whatness or essence of a thing or a person. So instead of saying quiditas, to make it easier for you, I'll say magic. Tell me, Lisa, what is your magic power?
Just to see the dots, be well before, just to see the dots, to see how things play out further down the line than people ever thought they would thought. You know, spotting trends long before people even know that's what they wanted. It is to know the need of somebody before they even know that they needed it, and the spot the dots, and then how to connect those dots and how it looks before it even was a concept. I don't know. I think that's, it's just this weird, and I've used that, you know, it's just innate in me, and it's been for every single, you know, industry that I've ever worked in. Yeah. I mean, I've just always been able to see, you know, the success of something and how it gets made, even when people are like, there's no way, you can't do that. Yeah. You know, and then it turns out like that. So, yeah. All right. I thought of one more thing.
Okay.
Don't burn any bridges. And I know your mother probably told you that. You probably learned it in kindergarten, but, you know, as much as you feel like you've been wronged by someone, you know, you never know when that person is kind of come back into your life, whether they'll be your boss, whether it'll be somebody who works for you, whether that, you know, yeah, don't ever burn a bridge. Try to find, you know, an understanding. Take a break if you have to, but at the end of the day, you'd be surprised how many people come back into your lives. And, you know, you may have a whole different relationship with that person in a good way. So, you know, just always, don't hold grudges.
And my last question for you as I end this great, fantastic, beautiful interview is, what does the future hold for Lisa G. Black?
Oh, my God. I hope I get to continue on, you know, impacting, you know, filmmakers that I come across and make great films. I think for me, I might, you know, try to transition into more speaking engagements and things like that, so I can help or at least inspire, you know, more people than just on each, you know, film or project. Does the future hold for me? Geez, you know, it's, I don't know. You know, all I can hope for is that I continue on, you know, being blessed in health and in relationships and, you know, and I have a long run of it. I want to be Olivia de Havilland and live to 104. That's what I want, you know. And be able to watch all the people around me, you know, live their best authentic lives. And if I'm blessed enough to be even a half a minute in that as an inspiration, you know, that's worth all the money in the bank.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the Quiditas Factor. Before we go, can you take us out?
This is Lisa G. Black, and you're listening to the Quiditas Factor.
Thank you for listening to the Quiditas Factor. I am Michael J. Arboy. Before I let you guys go, please visit my website at www.mikearboy.com. That's MikeArboet.com. And please check out the Quiditas page and go to my shop and go to Arbor Artifacts and buy a t-shirt that will help keep the show going, as well as my wife's Etsy store. That is Poem Jewelry Design. She makes wonderful jewelry. So if you're looking for something for someone, please check that out. And also, if you want to become a patron, please, by all means, check out my Patreon page. Click on the button on the website and become a patron for like $1 a month or $5 a month. You really help the show going, and I'll give you some secret tips and stuff that didn't end up in the broadcast. Little tidbits of knowledge and information that you might like. Please come back next Tuesday for an all-new episode of The Quiditas Factor. Thank you for listening.
Thanks so much for listening to The Quiditas Factor with Michael J. Arboway. We'll catch you next time.